Today's program has been brought to you by the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. EatWisconsinCheese.com.
I'm Julia Tertian, host of Radio Cherry Bomb. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, hello, and welcome to Pizza Party. I'm your host, Talia Ralph. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from none other than Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn, in wafting distance from some of New York's best pizza. Today, we have a true pizza guru in the studio. Scott Wiener, founder of Scott's Pizza Tours, has guided over 31,000 people through New York City's best pizza places. He's also the organizer of Slice Out Hunger, which doles out dollar slices of over 1,200 pizzas, and this year raised over $30,000 for the food bank for New York City this year. However, Scott is not just a master of what is in the box, he's masterpieced the boxes themselves. He is currently the Guinness World Record holder for the largest collection of pizza boxes in the world. He has 831 at last count, we just checked. He's also written a book on the subject out now called Viva la Pizza, and some of his boxes were recently on display in London and Berlin, and they are boxed up and headed to Manchester and possibly a city near you. So we're lucky to catch Scott on his way back from that European jot. Thanks for being with us, Scott.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, I mean, what was it like seeing your collection mounted in Europe? That's the kind of thing a lot of artists dream about their whole lives, and there they were.
Yeah, it was ridiculous because I collect these boxes and I don't keep them out and presented in my apartment. Mm-hmm. I keep them flattened down so they don't take up too much space. Mm-hmm. And seeing them up on the walls and these frames that we had built was incredible because I never get to see them all in one place.
Yeah.
And like doing the book was cool because I can look at all the boxes without having to take them out of my closet. But seeing them all together on one wall made so much sense because we put all the portraits together and we put all the boxes that were scenery and all these boxes that had funny depictions of pizza. Like, you know, we kind of grouped it into categories. Mm-hmm. And it just made it make so much more sense to see it like that. And it was just really a dream come true.
Cool. So how many did you mount? I assume not all.
No.
31.
No.
That must have been a tough narrowing down.
Yeah, we did just over 100 boxes.
Cool.
And it was really cool because, you know, I had to like pick and choose. So it was really fun that while the show was up, I was collecting boxes in Berlin and in London. And I was like, oh my goodness, if we do this again, this one's going to be in the show. And this one's going to be in the show.
And it's and you might be doing it again, right? Sounds like.
Yeah, it's, I mean, the whole thing was sponsored by this company called Delivery Hero, which is a Berlin-based food, online food ordering company, like Seamless, Grubhub, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And they're in 24 different countries. So there's a lot of opportunity to go to their markets that have people who might like something like this and have it be a branded event for them. And really all it costs them is to bring me and my designer, Steph Mantis, out and do these shows. And for us, it's just like a great way to see other cities and talk to people about pizza because it's just like pizza fanatics show up and they look at the boxes and they're like, wait a second, did you make these? Are you the artist? And I was like, no. These are really pizza boxes. Yeah. I just didn't throw them out. That was it.
I just kept them.
Yeah.
And just to clear it up, I mean, you don't keep the pizza boxes that you eat pizza out of. You keep, you know, you get a fresh one and it is pristine and
exactly.
It's cardboard.
Well, most of them. So some of them, like sometimes people give me, I get a lot of boxes from people who take pizza tours with me, mm-hmm. or they'll mail them to me. And sometimes they're used and I'm like, oh no, but I'm not going to go to Korea and get another one of these. So I scrape out the cheese and I coat it with like some polyurethane or something. Mm-hmm. So I actually have some boxes in my hallway right now drying out because somebody gave me boxes from Pennsylvania and, you know.
So how tall is like a flattened stack of 831 pizza boxes?
That's an amazing question because I just measured. So if you keep the boxes built, uh-huh. I am 32 pizza boxes tall.
Awesome.
And if you flatten them down, then that 32 is just about to the middle of my shin.
Oh, wow.
So it's really not a lot of space.
Super compressed, yeah.
Yeah. But we calculated it. And if you kept all the boxes constructed and then mm-hmm. stacked them on top of each other, it would be like a 15-story building's height.
Wow.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Do you know what that is? Flat, though, or no? Never
no.
done it, I guess.
No, I mean, I guess I
just
could
have them
the
in piles?
Yeah. I mean, right now, so the way that there are is they're stacked according to dimension. So there's a 13-inch box or an 18-inch box. You know, when you flatten them down, they're a lot larger because the walls go down. So I have them all stacked according to size, and then they're kind of bundled together with twine. So maybe I have 50 or 60 in each bundle, and then they fit into my closet in sort of like a Tetris scenario.
That's like, it's especially impressive, as like New Yorkers who are listening right now know, to dedicate a closet to that kind of storage. I mean, this is the city that jokes about like storing clothes in their ovens, you know?
Yeah, so. And it's true. I mean, I'm right now for the first time ever looking into getting a storage unit just because the collection's growing so much. And I feel like it's worth it to keep them around if I can keep traveling around because of the boxes. So
for sure.
We'll see.
So what to you makes a box worth collecting?
So at first, for me, it was customization. So I wanted to see a box that was a specific pizzeria that had chosen iconography to represent what it is that they do as their food. And I thought that that was really, really cool. You know, get a box from Turkey, and of course it'll have Turkish writing on it, and maybe it'll have imagery of a person, a chef who looks Turkish, and, you know, something that represented the locale that it's from. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of how I got into it. But then I started realizing that the generic boxes were maybe more interesting, because when you get a custom box, that's marketing for your pizzeria. Mm-hmm. But when you use a generic box, it just says hot, delicious, tasty, whatever. It's marketing nothing but the enjoyment of pizza, which we don't even need to be marketed to.
Needs no marketing.
So, I mean, the collection's changed a lot. Now, I kind of take anything now, because I realize that when you take something that you see, it seems boring at first look. But when you put it up next to other examples that are similar or polar opposite, that's when it becomes interesting. So now if I have a box that has the boring, you know, the chef going like the, giving the wink and with the hat, you know, you have enough of those, then you start to see the differences in the drawings. And, you know, maybe this is from a plate, the printing plate. Maybe it's a printing plate that's older, or maybe it's the fresh one. And it becomes really interesting when you put them next to each other.
For sure. So do you have any like design or art marketing background? Do you do any of this stuff, or you're just a collector?
I have zero design background. I'm terrible. I'm not an artist. I'm awful at that stuff. I just really like pizza. And I feel like the boxes are a really fun way to look at it, because I get so bored of, you know, criticizing different pizzas and things, and which is something I don't do. I don't write reviews. I don't do that kind of thing. I like to enjoy it. But I feel like Pizza Box is something that's really this unsung hero, because 2/3 of all pizzas eaten in America are eaten out of pizza boxes. And if you care so much about your oven, then maybe you should be caring about the thing that carries the pizza to the person who's going to consume it. Because that box, for the most part, destroys pizza. Big pizza boxes are the worst. I don't like them for what they're built for, but I like them as sort of an example, as a tool that's used in the pizza industry, that it's just like you can't ignore it. It's like being a runner and not thinking about your shoes.
Wow, that's a powerful metaphor. You know, and because you brought this up, My dad is out there and he's going to laugh. I told him that I wasn't going to take his question advice necessarily, but he called me today and he was talking about a pizzeria that we used to go to a lot that we'll talk about in a second when we talk about the pizza table. But they used to have a method of putting like a very thick sheet of aluminum underneath the pizza. And he like missed that so much and lobbied for it, because he said that it gave it like this kind of, it kept it crisp and hot, and like they stopped doing it and no one knows why, and he like begged for it back. So I'm wondering if you in your pizza encounters have found like the ideal box, or do you think we're still looking for it?
Well, I don't know if any box is truly ideal, because the problem with pizza is that it's best eaten in the place where it's made. So there's no pizza box that will really deliver a pizza that tastes as good or better. So, and part of it is because you're losing heat and you're trapping steam. And that's a problem, because if you have a lot of ports in the box that allow steam to escape, then you're also losing heat.
Right.
But we have to talk about relative humidity with this, because if you have ports designed in such a way that the steam will escape, but heat can be trapped via conduction, that's when you start to make some headway. And there's one box out of India called the Vented Box, which has these ports that are indirect ports. And I know this is maybe tough over radio, but if you think about corrugated cardboard, it's three layers. There's a outer liner, there's an inner liner, and between those two flat pieces of paper, there's the wavy paper, which gives it structure. So when you make a pizza box, those three are glued together, and then they're stamped in the shape of the box with all the holes and the ports and everything. Now, if you stamp out the ports and the holes before you glue those pieces together, then you can make ports that don't line up. You can have a hole that's maybe an inch over in the inside from the outer liner, which is an inch to the right, maybe. So this way, you're separating the two holes. Instead of making one hole straight through all three pieces of paper, yeah, you're sliding them so they're adjacent, which allows steam to travel through the fluting, the wavy paper, and it exits out the top. So it's very, very cool. If you want more information about it, just look online for Ventit, V-E-N-T-I-T. I'm sure I've posted stuff about it at my blog, which is blog.scottspizzatours.com. It's just like a Tumblr blog. You can just look it up on Tumblr. Or just email me. I will send you pictures. Awesome. I have a stack of them in my living room if you need one.
I will. I think I can picture it. But if anybody's interested, let us know. Scott will get you one. But you're also, I mean, clearly pizza is a vehicle for understanding a lot of things. And one of your self-professed favorite things to do is sort of debunk myths or sort of histories. And so I would love it personally. You know, I have a little bucket list of things that I've been wanting to talk about. And the first is the history of the dollar slice in New York City, because I've been doing some research into it and I have it dated in like the early 2000s, which seems really recent. But I don't know if you know, you know, where it started, how and why. And I know you have a lot of feelings about the dollar slice. So maybe we could start with that.
Well, I mean, OK, first of all, when you sell a slice of pizza for a dollar today in 2014 in New York City, it means that you're cutting corners and it's not going to be a product that you might choose if just based on taste alone. It's something that's being chosen by because of value, bang for the buck. So I just want to get that out there. Personally, I don't really enjoy eating many dollar slices. There are some that are decent, but you know, I'd rather pay, you know, $1.75 more for a slice that's like 10 times better, you know? But that being said, into the history of it, which is just, let's ignore the taste of it altogether. Remember that pizza was a dollar per slice, you know, like 15 years ago, 18 years ago, somewhere around there. You know, it was a dollar a slice. So the early 2000s is definitely when 99-cent fresh pizza was around right by Port Authority. And I remember, I guess the first time I ever had that was probably 2003 or 2004. I used to live in Hoboken. So when waiting for the 126 bus, I would go over and get a dollar slice, and it would keep me company while I was waiting in that gigantic line.
The best friend you could ever have.
Yeah, it was. And like, but that's what it is. It's comfort. Now, the history of it is really, it's kind of interesting. I mean, you have 99 cent fresh, and then you have Two Bros that starts up right around the, you know, the economic crumbling of 2008, which is clearly the impetus for what spreads the dollar slice, which is that you have these guys opening these places all over, and the whole idea is volume. Sell it for a dollar, more people will come in and buy it, and then you'll be able to pay your rent, whereas selling it for $2.50, $2.75, you might not be able to pull it in because of volume. So, you know, that being said, I walked past the Two Bros on 6th Avenue and maybe 14th Street, wherever it is, 23rd Street the
23rd,
other day.
23rd, yeah.
Yeah. That's walked past it the other day, and it was so beautiful. To see, just to see all these different people, guys in suits, guys in construction, guys, cops, the, you know, just every men, women, children, everybody eating pizza together in a way that I feel like New York pizza became something special because it was the thing that everybody could get. And for that reason, I think the dollar slice is actually kind of great for what it symbolizes. You look at a picture from 1975 of Joe's on Bleecker Street, and like, it looks the same. A corner.
Or Lombardi's in 1926.
Yeah. Well, man, that's getting a little different. But you know what I mean? Like dollar, like a slice culture.
It's true, yes.
Slice culture. It's all about, slice culture is like the pizzeria as a collecting place. But anyway, so I think that that's kind of beautiful. But now this is something not proven, but I talk to people all the time about this kind of stuff. It seems to be, and like, I'm definitely going to be looking into this some more, and if somebody wants to help me do some research, is that I heard a rumor that a lot of the sort of when Giuliani cleaned up Times Square and like all the theaters on 42nd Street, that some of those spaces then to continue their lease, that people who ran those spaces converted them into some of these dollar slice places.
Interesting.
Which is just kind of a funny, weird tangent. It's been on my whiteboard for maybe a year and a half. Like, look into this. It says like porno dollar slice. And like anybody sees that and they're like, what are you up to? And I'm like, don't worry.
That's crazy because our first ever guest, Colin Hagendorf, actually, I forget, he's going to be so mad at me. I forget who the scholar was, but he references sort of, he made a similar statement about sort of like the cross section of people that enter a pizza place. And so he actually made that connection through reading about the history of sort of the cruising culture in Times Square. So that's really fascinating. Maybe you guys are on the same brainwave, but if he won't help you, I will. So the second, which we were talking about a little bit before we went on air, were the little pizza tables. Like, what is the deal with the pizza table? Because as I've discussed on Snacky Tunes and with other guests, there are far more efficient and edible ways to sort of keep that propped up. But how did the pizza table become like the de facto way to keep your box from touching your pizza?
So first of all, I love that every listener knows what you're talking about, even though you refer to it as a table, which it clearly is not. It's the little plastic thing in the inside. Everybody knows.
Is there an official name?
Table. There is. And I was I wanted to bring you the patent, but I couldn't find it in my files. I'll find it. I'll email it to you. It's called the Package Saver, and it was invented in 1983 by a woman named Carmela Vitale from Dix Hills, New York. She was a school teacher. She had never invented anything before. She gets the patent in 85. Mm-hmm. And the idea, of course, is that these things, calling it the package saver, means that you can market it for, you know, protecting packages. If you call it the pizza saver, and then suddenly, you know, these other food companies don't want to use them. Obviously, it's just used for pizza. That's what it is. And, you know, there have been so many other patents for it that use less plastic and that are triangles instead of the circles or just the lines. It's amazing. But, you know, they were made because at that time, the pizza boxes that were in use were these single sheet cardboard. And when it's a corrugated box, we don't call it cardboard. Mm-hmm. When it's just a thin sheet, that's when we call it cardboard. Right. So it's a cardboard, and it's what they call, what do you call it? Paperboard.
Okay.
So paperboard, you know, you know how the corners have those tabs?
Yep, it's like a glorified Bristol board.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and they're terrible for pizza. But anyway, when you had those, as pizza became more popular, more pizzas were getting stacked on top of each other, and then it starts to crush down on the bottom pizza. So you need that support in there. Now that we're using corrugated boxes, they're more structurally sound. You can do two or three pizzas and have no problem at all. Mm-hmm. So, you know, those little things are going.
The little pizza tables are obsolete. I just like calling them pizza table, especially because there's that adorable little photo, which I'm sure most of you out there have seen with the little chair next to the pizza table. But anyway.
I've only seen it just like a week ago. It was the first time I saw it, which is why I emailed it to you.
Yeah, it's cute. We'll put it on the Facebook after for those of you that have not been blessed with the pizza table and chair. but the third and final myth we'll clear up right before the break is that your book, Viva la Pizza, obviously not only showcases pizza art, but it delves into the history of the box. And I'm wondering, you know, what is that history? And more specifically, what were we transporting pizza in before the box? Which, because obviously pizza's been around for much longer than we've been building cardboard boxes, so.
Absolutely, but remember, pizza wasn't being eaten the same way that we eat it now. It wasn't, hey, give me three pies, deliver it to me, or I'll pick it up, whatever. It was, pizza was a single-serving food. So in the early 1900s, in Italy, in Naples, in southern Italy, or in New York, it was something that was being handed to one person who would then eat it out of a piece of paper, much like fish and chips, mm-hmm. you know? And look at any peasant food. They're being transported in paper, newsprint, like, you know, paper that's probably not safe to eat off of. That's what we were using for pizza. Then it shifts into the paper bag. Mm-hmm. And some listeners may know places that still do this. There are some that do this.
Roberta's does. Takeout next door. Paper bag. Well, on a plate. But it's like a plate.
They don't use the box?
For just a slice, no.
Oh, okay. They do slices?
Yeah.
Wait,
word is out.
Blow my mind about this. Anyway. I just found out, by the way, they delivered it to my apartment now, so that's bad news.
Always exciting to find out.
But anyway.
Sorry.
So it's, okay, like on a cardboard slab in a paper bag, but these paper bags that were designed for pizzas. So that was the next step. Mm-hmm. Then we made the progression into those chipboard or paperboard boxes. And it was kind of a link from bakery boxes, you know, mm-hmm. when you get a cake mm-hmm. and it's in these taller boxes, but they have those tabs to lock the sides. Mm-hmm. It was those because pizza was something being made in bakeries. So it wasn't just out of nowhere that pizzerias just exploded. They were being made in bakeries. So you pack it in whatever you already have. It's that thinner version of the box. That's something that, and it's really hard to pinpoint a date on it. And in the book, I actually say something that since then, a friend of mine who's also a pizza researcher found a quote in a book that references pizza boxes earlier than that, in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I kind of seen, it seemed to me that like the 1940s were when boxes started to happen, but, you know, it comes out of this bakery technology. And then we get box printing happening in the 40s and 50s. And then suddenly in the 80s, we have the corrugated boxes. And then you have the octagonal boxes start to happen, mm-hmm. where people are trying to cut the corners literally just so they can save money. And
now we have the green box, which is the next wave.
Absolutely.
Well, on that note, we're going to take a quick break, but don't go anywhere just yet. We have your pizza news break of the week, and we're catching up on a very busy Thanksgiving week in pizza.
Pizza news brief.
So pizza is not exempt from the FDA's new calorie counting laws, which were announced last week. The rules require all restaurants to clearly display calorie information on menus, and yes, that includes pizza delivery joints, though they will get a bit of leeway on topping calorie counts. So stay tuned, whether that's good or bad for you pizza eaters out there. I think it's a great thing. Scott is making a face.
Well, I just have a question. I had read that it was only for restaurants that have at least 20 locations. Is that true?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
I haven't actually looked at the law itself, but it's been
pretty extensive. Because like if you have more than 20 or more, then like that's okay. Because like the little mom and pops are still safe.
Yeah.
Sorry.
It's going to be tough. But also on the subject of pizza boxes, actually, South Korean Papa John's have rolled out a new design called the all-in-one box. I don't know if you've seen this, but it's exactly what it sounds like. It's a triple-decker box that holds a large pizza, four sides, dips, pickles, and a giant chocolate chip cookie. There's also a 2015 calendar on top, presumably for planning your pizza orders accordingly. But sadly, the Telegraph reports that for now, the box is a Korean exclusive and won't be sold in the UK or the US. Pizza Underground, Macaulay Culkin's band, performed recently, although did not get such great reviews, which is sad because we over here at Pizza Party are big fans of Pizza Underground and everything they stand for. So there is some exciting pizza news going on. We're going to take a quick break. We will be back in just a minute with Scott Wiener, who is the founder of Scott's Pizza Tours and the Guinness World Record holder for most pizza boxes in the world. We'll be back. Stay tuned.
You are listening to Honey by Renee Lopez. Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
It is so exciting to have this new medium.
Hosting After the Jump has been a huge part of me transitioning from being a blogger to somebody who has sort of real important conversations with people in real life.
My show, I kind of describe it as an audio trade magazine.
I learn a ton from the guests every week, whether it's restaurants, bars.
All the hosts at Heritage all come from different perspectives.
Everyone should be listening to this. If you're interested in conservation and practical approach to renewable food sources, you know, not this big industry.
Whether it's history, laws, social policies of food, I think people now take food seriously, and hopefully what's on their plate will become something very special.
And I feel that podcasting has a future, giving people information in a format they can really use on the go.
We need your support to keep these conversations going. To donate, visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
This is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, and you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back to Pizza Party. I'm your host, Talia Ralph. We are in the studio with Scott Wiener, who is a pizza aficionado, total expert, and avid pizza box collector. He is currently displaying some of his collection in Europe. Thanks for being with us, Scott.
Thank you again for having me.
And we are just talking about the, you know, brutal situation we face of having to talk while eating pizza at the same time and negotiating that. And it's all very hard for us here in the
studio. It's really difficult.
Well, we're eating the Jersey Devil, which is your home state, right? So talk to us a little bit about how and when you met pizza. When did it come into your life? And subsequently, sort of when you knew that you were going to start Scott's Pizza Tours, because I read a bit about it. It sounds like it came at the end of a long soul search and clearly has been, you know, a real successful endeavor. You've been featured on the Food Network, Cooking Channel, Travel Channel, and now, of course, Heritage Radio.
This is the big show. this is it.
You've made it to the top. There's nowhere to go from here.
Seriously.
But yeah, early pizza memories and sort of how you started.
I mean, I got into pizza the way that any other human does, where, you know, it's delicious and you get it because, you know, my parents didn't want to cook for one night, or, you know, I've got soccer practice and my brother's got guitar lessons or whatever it is. And, you know, it's a solution food. It's let's go pick up a pizza. Everybody will be happy. Nobody's going to be whining about it. And it's quick and easy and portable. So it just makes a lot of sense. But, you know, those nights where everybody's eating pizza are so rare, because when you go to a restaurant, everybody orders their own thing. Oh, how's your pasta? Oh, how's your steak? Oh, how's your chicken? And like, maybe you share a couple bites, but really you're each having your own experience. When you go for pizza, it's a shared experience. So even though you might take the slice and doctor it up with chili flakes or oregano or whatever, it's a shared thing that you all get together and you make a decision. Like when I walked into the studio and you said, all right, we're going to order two pizzas. What should we do? Like, we had a conversation about it. It was not just like, well, I'm going to get this one and I'm going to eat the whole thing. And then you're going to get that. And I don't want them to ever even go near each other.
Right.
No way. I want to eat all of it. I want to share all of it. So it's just this sharing food. And I think that stayed with me so much, which is why, I mean, I guess in the timeline, you know, in college, you know, I went to school in Syracuse, New York, which did not have a good pizza scene at the time. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, I just saw there's some article that said that it has one of the best pizza scenes of any college campus. I don't know. I think it's a lie.
You're like, not when I was there.
No, definitely when I was there. Disgusting. But, you know, it was so much. I would go home and eat pizza because it was like salvation. It was like, oh, at least I can, you know, get back home. The first thing you do is go and eat good pizza. So I think that just stayed with me. And then, you know, after school, I don't know, maybe it was soul searching, but, you know, I never had the concept that I wanted to have a career and stick with one thing and kind of follow it, because I was in television production and sound production, working in recording studios and film and television for a little bit. And it just kind of got boring, and I didn't like anybody I was working for, and I didn't want to be in their positions. So at that time, I was fortunate enough to have a living situation that was free, which was amazing. And surprisingly enough, was not my parents' house. This is where it gets even weirder. I don't know if we have enough time, but I was living on a historic ferry boat. I was the caretaker for this old ferry boat, and I was giving like impromptu tours to people who would just walk onto the pier in the middle of the day in Hoboken, New Jersey. And I just love the history and understanding that this thing that you walk past every day on your way to work might have some real historical significance. And it's the only surviving Ellis Island ferry, and I just fell in love with it. And by the way, it's in Red Hook now. If anybody wants to go, email me. I'll take you there.
Wow.
But
cool.
That just got me into the whole history of things. And, you know, when I'd quit my job, which I was doing sound, I just kind of spent 6 months not applying for jobs. And during that 6 months, I was driving my friends to pizzerias and going on little day trips. And that turned into my 26th birthday party, which was I just rented a school bus and we drove around to six different pizzerias. And I gave everybody a little goodie bag and notebook so they could take notes. And that was the blueprint for what I ended up doing. Exactly 6 months later was Scott's Pizza Tours. Where it was just, we just do that. It's like a birthday party every time.
That's awesome. Wow. Well, now everyone's officially jealous of your job, not just me. What do you think makes Scott's Pizza Tours different from other pizza tours? Because we've had some other, you know, great people on air that also do, you know, pizza pilgrimages, you know, have eaten every slice on the island of Manhattan. So what is it about what you do that you feel is unique, special, gives people a new spin on pizza?
Well, there's a big difference between, like, when I go out and I was just in London, and I had never really eaten a lot of pizza in London, and we would go out on a big pizza crawl, like, you know, go check out a bunch of pizzerias. That is, like, the most fun thing you could ever do. Go to a bunch of places, eat a slice at each, and then you chat about it on the way. And I call that a crawl, and I call what we do, what I do as a business, is a tour, and I separate the two, because with the tour, it's organized based on there's some kind of a storyline and there's some context given at each place. So like what we do and why the tour is something different from just going and eating pizza is that it's this organized sketch of a story. And so there's context at each place. So you understand the oven type. We go into the kitchens and we learn about, you know, what type of wood are they burning? Where are they putting that wood in the oven? And how is that changing the heat structure inside the oven? And, you know, even down to how is the dough being handled at this place, which is different from the other place? Why are they handling it differently? Is it because of the oven type? Is it because of the fuel source? Is it because of where they're from or where they learn to make pizza? I mean, it's just like it's a lot deeper that goes in. And I get emails all the time that say, oh, hey, are you going to go to this place on the pizza tour? Because if you do, then I'll go on that pizza tour. And I'm like, I mean, if you want to go to Roberta's, go to Roberta's. Just go. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't need me to take you to a pizzeria. Mm-hmm. The tour is not about me taking you out for pizza. It's about leading you through the understanding process about how it is that pizza came to be. And so, I mean, I get people all the time who come in as, like, pizza snobs. And the idea is to make you leave not being a pizza snob. To just somebody who understands the depth of what's going on and create a higher respect for it. So it's really, you know, just out of respect for what it is, a simple food that is simple yet not easy. And that's something you got to break down.
You're unsnobifying the world. This is valiant work. So you guys have five different tours and they're all different neighborhoods, right? Each one sort of focuses on a different neighborhood. So I know this might be a controversial question, but where do you think the best pizza is happening in New York right now? And I know that we're plying you with Roberta's. We're not trying to suck up to you, but where, you know, what borough, neighborhood, specific place? I mean, however specific you want to get.
It's a great question because it's, I mean, you're talking about, it's sort of like, what's the best pizza city? And if you're asking me about locations, it has to be, it's about diversity and quality. So it's, if it's an area that just has like three really good slice shops, that's not going to be my favorite pizza neighborhood. Right now, I've got really two. We're talking like Greenwich Village, West Village kind of situation, because you've got Coal Oven like John's and Arturo's, two different ends of the Coal Oven spectrum. You've got slice shops like Joe's, and Bleecker Street Pizza, and then you've got Caste doing like some of the best Neapolitan pizza in the whole city. That's a great neighborhood for pizza. It's mm-hmm. really, really good, which is why we do a tour in that neighborhood, mm-hmm. because I want to eat that all the time.
Right.
But then you get the East Village. And I know these are both downtown, but like, let's just be honest, that's where it's at. But you got Luzzo's and you got Motorino on the same block? Where you just walk around the corner and you're from one or the other? Like, that's insane. And they're both different types of wood-burning pizza. Luzzo's is wood and coal, but it's a larger pizza, and it's baked at, it's funny, it's baked at a lower temperature, but it's a faster bake because of the shape of the oven. It's kind of crazy. Mm-hmm. But Motorino, which had this funky, puffy crust, you know, you get those, and then unfortunately South Brooklyn Pizza closed, but when they were down the street, that was a good slice, mm-hmm. you know, which was pretty awesome. But I just feel like neighborhoods like that, even in the Lower East Side, is getting kind of interesting right now. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, oh no, you know what? I got another one. I feel like Williamsburg, Brooklyn is, with Best Pizza and Fornino, and now there's a Two Boots over there. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, they're, I'm going to leave Anna Maria maybe out of it.
Yeah.
Like, unless it's really late at night, maybe. But still, you know, like, it's a good pizza diverse neighborhood, and that's what you need.
I like this. I like your approach. Although, you know, poor Brooklyn. I mean, you threw in Williamsburg at the last minute but we're like, you know.
I got one more for you, actually, because now I just realized.
What about the big classics? What about like L&B? I mean, I guess.
Okay, but you're asking about pizza neighborhood. Right. L&B stands alone in that neighborhood.
Right.
You know what I mean? I was there yesterday and like.
Casing the joint or something else.
No. I'm there all the time. I mean, yesterday's tour was like ridiculous. We did like, you know, it's like saying that Midwood is a good pizza neighborhood because Defara is there. It's not a good pizza neighborhood. It's a terrible pizza neighborhood. Defara is one thing that's there, mm-hmm. and it's like a fluke of a place. You know what I mean?
Right.
But Cobble Hill is really cool. And we're actually, I just realized, we're starting a Brooklyn pizza walking tour starting this Saturday, December 6th. Which is going to be, we're going to go to like Soto Casa, which is on Atlantic, I guess more like Borum Hill. And we're going to go to Sam's, which opened in 1930 with a coal-fired oven, and now it's a gas-fired oven, but it's the same old brick oven. And we'll go to Enoteca. There's a South Brooklyn Pizza over there that's like really crunchy, maybe a little too crunchy for me. And then, you know, there's like all these places over there that are just really solid. House of Pizza and Calzone in Columbia Waterfront. Mm-hmm. Oh, man, with their fried calzones and their upside-down pizzas, which is really good.
Upside-down pizza.
Yeah.
Whoa, okay.
Yeah. I mean, like, yeah.
I see what you're saying.
Now I'm thinking about more neighborhoods.
Your line of argument, and we have gotten lots of good recommendations. So before we wrap up, because sadly we're out of time, I'm going to ask you you know, the question to end all questions on Pizza Party, which is, why do you love pizza so much? And why do you think other people love pizza so much? What is the appeal? You can be as philosophical and metaphysical as you would like.
And start literal. It's delicious. It tastes good.
It does.
Forget about everything else. It is delicious and everybody loves it. But when you get deeper, pizza for me is symbolic of so many other things. It's this simple item that you walk past every day, or you can experience it every day. But when you look deeper into it, you start to understand how complex it is. And how, if you understand, okay, cheese, sauce, and crust, how much could go on? Well, wait a second. That crust is made of a dough. That dough is made of flour, salt, water, and yeast, maybe sugar, maybe oil, maybe something else that's crazy. Well, what type of flour is it? Or what's the temperature of the water that you're using? Or what kind of yeast? Or what kind of salt? And when you start to realize that there are options with all these things, there's a decision-making process that goes along with it. And good pizza is pizza that's made when those decisions are thought about. And bad pizza is when you follow a recipe and don't think about the decisions. And I feel like that's what opens it up so much more. So it's this deeper understanding of something really basic. And if you can get into pizza at that kind of level, then you start to look at everything else a little differently. And I feel like for pizza, as I said before, everybody can talk about it. You can be in an elevator going up 100 floors in the One World Trade or whatever, and you could just say to somebody, hey, what's your favorite pizzeria? And I guarantee that whole elevator ride, you will be having a conversation. Yeah. I've met people from all over the world, over 30,000 people, and they're so excited about talking about pizza on pizza tours. Then you meet them out in the wild, and people are always excited about talking about it. You know, it's just like, it's the gateway to understanding, and I guess that's as philosophical as I think I can get about it. But at least, you know, after only eating two slices, maybe like three, and then I get a little pizza tipsy.
Yes, well, we have more slices to eat, but we are out of time on the air. This has been another awesome episode of Pizza Party. Thank you all so much for tuning in. Our guest today has been Scott Wiener, the founder and head tour guide of Scott's Pizza Tours. So if you guys are curious about any of their neighborhoods, they can find you where,
Scott? Oh, they can go to scottspizzatours.com, or Twitter is Scott's Pizza Tour, Instagram is Scott's Pizza Tours, and Facebook/New York Pizza Tours.
Perfect. Thank you guys so much for listening. We will be back next week. And yes, there will be pizza.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.